Now, a key to all of this, Sarah, is that the Barack Obama administration was behind it. They nullified the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948, which had precluded the use of the same techniques of disinformation and propaganda within the United States that were being used without. In other words, they unleashed a barrage, a flood of propaganda on the American people by taking that measure. So that already by 1975, William Colby, then its director, testified to Congress that the agency owned everyone of any significance in the media. And to date, it's much, much worse. Listen, Sarah, for the sake of the audience, let's just begin at the beginning. You were saying once you realized that the school was closed, case closed. And I couldn't agree more.
Get the best priced and most bioavailable TA65 telomere lengthening product on the market, the BioEnhance TA65. Being that TA65 has been proven to lengthen human telomeres, it has historically been priced at thousands of dollars and out of reach for most people. But this new low-dose formulation with up to 50 times better absorption now makes it a realistic option for those seeking the telomere lengthening benefits of TA65. At only $100 per bottle, it is now more affordable than ever at the lowest price seen in the market. Buy today with confidence with the link below. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This is my interview with Professor James Fetzer on the Sandy Hook massacre and his research and how he's showing that Sandy Hook never occurred. It was a FEMA drill. Nobody died. That's his take on it. And he's written books and they've all been censored heavily. Amazon will not air it or let it be on their site. He does give the book away for free now, and it's self-published with his own publishing company. But currently, just like with Alex Jones, there is a major lawsuit against him, Lenny Posner, against Fetzer. They're saying that he's harassing the victims and that they have no right to do, that he has no right, and either does the other, Alex Jones and others that are researching this, have any right to doing what they're doing. And it's a very, very important freedom of speech case. Our First Amendment rights are at stake with this case. Now, the media is ignoring it completely, but this case is important because if he loses, basically propaganda wins and people cannot even speak up against the powers of the government and say, this is a false flag and this is not true, this is not real. Even if this case is real, let's say that these are real victims, and they could be. I'm going to tell you right now, I am not an expert at Sandy Hook, but James Fetzer's information here is really intriguing. And those who've researched this all come to the same conclusion that there's major issues here. But regardless, let's say it is real, just hypothetically, for people not to be able to research it and question it, is an incredible loss of freedom of speech and our right to question the power of our government. So that's why I'm airing this interview. I'm not airing it on YouTube because anytime you put this guy up on YouTube and you even question whether this situation occurred, they strike the account and they've taken down a lot of people's accounts because he's been on their show. And that's another indication of a major abuse against our freedom of speech. You can't question the government. That's why this is a landmark case on freedom of speech. And so for those of you who are my Patreons, I will have a lot of the court documents up on Patreon so you can see the actual court documents. You can get them also on his blog, jamesfetzer.org, but I will have them all in one place for you if you're interested in that and you want to support my Patreon channel. That's how I keep going. The way I keep going is funding through my Patreon. I also have affiliates, so if there's something that you think that you like that I'm selling through my affiliates, that helps me as well. So anyways, let's get into this very important interview. It's a two-parter with Professor James Fetzer.
Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Oh, Sarah, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much. I've heard many good things about you.
Well, thank you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, and I got to be honest. I was a little scared to put you on my show because of the censorship, and so many channels have been shut down because of it. But that's not right, right? It's just, this isn't right. And you are in one of the most important lawsuits. It's a landmark freedom of speech lawsuit, along with so many other elements to this, that this is worthy news. And I really think that doing this interview is very important for people to see.
Well, so many have had not only, you know, their YouTubes, for example, taken down because they did interviews with me. And of course, many of mine have disappeared on the right and the left. And it turns out the fellow who's suing me is running an operation that appears to be performing cyber terrorism on behalf of the deep state. It's called the Honor Network. And if you go to the website, you'd find he claims that it was founded after Sandy Hook in order to defend the parents from harassment by Sandy Hook skeptics. But Sarah, it turns out that he obtained the domain name in 2005, 7 years before Sandy Hook. And it stands not for honor, but for hands-on network resources, where this guy has boasted in a recent interview that his group has been responsible for taking down over 10,000 content items from the internet, where one of my videos would constitute one content item. He's taken down over 10,000.
Wow. Yeah. That, I mean, he's a big element of the censorship that's going on. And I'd love to have him on if he's suing you, which there's a big lawsuit there. You know, you're part of this whole Alex Jones. Alex Jones is being sued, and that's really highlighted in the media, but they're so quiet about your lawsuit against them. Why do you think they are not actively talking about you in this lawsuit?
Well, it's one thing to go after Alex Jones, who may or may not be the comedian Bill Hicks and the New Guys, but he's made a joke out of himself. The program used to be significant because it would raise issues about puzzling situations where it wasn't obvious what's going on and invite speculation. Those are two of the first stages in scientific reasoning, thinking things through. Puzzlement, speculation, then adaptation of seeing how alternative hypotheses fit the evidence or not, leading to evaluations about what's the most plausible explanation, where when the evidence is settled down, you're entitled to accept the best supported hypothesis as true, but in the tentative, infallible fashion of science, meaning that even though it's best supported, it's not guaranteed to be true. And if it's tentative in the sense that with the acquisition of new evidence, new alternative hypotheses, we may have to reject some we previously accept some we previously rejected, and leave others in suspense. So Alex turns out to be an easy target. He appears to be folding. Sarah, you'll be fascinated to know that I've been so supportive of him that I have sent him evidence, copies of the book that Amazon banned. I even entered as an amicus curiae, friend of the court in Texas, and put in evidence proving that they had faked the kids using photographs of older kids when they were younger. That's sitting in the files in the court case in Texas. But he and his attorney have never even appealed to it. He never had me on his show. Wolfgang is another who's been subjected to attack. He's a more difficult target because he is a former Florida State Trooper. He's a former U.S. Customs agent. He's a former school principal. He's a nationally recognized school safety expert. And Sarah, he got into Sandy Hook only because he wanted to learn what really happened so that he could advise school systems on how to make sure it didn't happen to him. He made inquiries, made phone calls. His FOIA requests were unreturned. His phone calls went unanswered. Before he knew it, there were two homicide detectives from the local precinct on his porch in his gated community in Florida, telling him they were there on behalf of the state police from Connecticut, and that if he didn't stop asking questions about Sandy Hook, that he would be prosecuted. That was the wrong thing to say with Wolfgang. But you find articles today, and there have been quite a few, that demonize him for harassing parents when he was doing no such thing. In fact, a an associate professor at Florida Atlantic by the name of James Tracy was the first to publish a scholarly article about Sandy Hook regarding the press conference that Wayne Carver, the state medical examiner, held that day, in which he explained that they didn't allow the parents to view the children's bodies, that there'd be a time for that, but that they were identified on the basis of photographs. And Sarah, we have now been able to establish that that was appropriate because the kids were fictions who only existed in the form of photographs. Some, in fact, Mona Alexis Presley has been quite brilliant in doing research in this area where, may I add, all of my research is collaborative, whether it's on JFK or 9/11 or Sandy Hook or the Boston bombing or any of these other false flag events where I have brought together experts and published books, which are available at moonrockbooks.com. It was the right thing to do because they were perpetrating a scam, and where Mona has established that some of the parents seem to have used photographs of themselves when they were children. And just to give you a sense of the monstrosity of the scam, Sarah, sympathetic but gullible Americans contributed between $27 and $130 million in donations and sympathy for the loss of these children, which divided by the 26 families that are supposed to be the survivors comes to between $1 and $5 million for feigning to have lost a child at Sandy Hook. Let me say, we already have the FEMA manual. All this was published in the book, and Nobody Died at Sandy Hook in 2015, where I have 13 contributors, including 6 current or retired PhD professors. Now, the answer to your question is really very straightforward. It's one thing to debunk a guy who's kind of made a clown out of himself. On the one hand, Alex Jones, who appears to be going on, you know, taking the fall on behalf of the deep state, where he's got evidence readily available that I provided that he has chosen not even to deploy, although it would give him a complete vindication, or even to go after Wolfgang Halbig, who is kind of a reticent fellow. He's very folksy, but he's not overly articulate and doesn't have much of a presence, even though he's been doggedly determined and made many significant finds, including, for example, determining that the first select man of Newtown under oath, a woman named Patricia LaLorda, that's a position equivalent to mayor, under oath acknowledged that the sign, "Everyone must check in," was actually placed there by Department of Homeland Security when Homeland Security ought to have had nothing to do with it. But it confirms that it was a FEMA drill, actually a 2-day exercise. We not only have the sign, "Everyone must check in," and it says right in the manual, "Everyone must check in," but we had porta potties in place. We had pizza and bottled water at the firehouse. You're going to have a hard time finding any crime in the United States where they have porta potties in place and pizza and bottled water available. You have many with name tags on lanyards. You had parents bringing children to the scene. Now, Sarah, as you can imagine, no parent is going to bring a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. But this was a rehearsal. This was the 13th, and they were treating it as a festive occasion. So we have a monstrous amount of evidence that confirms this was actually a FEMA drill. And in fact, the following day, there was no surge of EMTs into the building. There was no string of ambulances to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they could be pronounced dead or alive. There were no medevac helicopter called, which Wolfgang has observed they even do for drills. I think they were so self-conscious they didn't want to make it look like a drill, even though it was a drill and would have been more appropriate had it been real to have brought in a medevac helicopter. But the owners there sat waiting for phone calls that never came. They put out triage tarps, but no bodies were ever placed on it. In fact, we'll go through some of the evidence that confirms the findings of the 13 contributors to the book. The school had been closed by 2008. It was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, damaged by hurricanes. There were no students there.
To me, all I have to hear is the school was closed. Somebody has, I don't, that's why I'm having a hard time with this whole thing. I, you know, I, when this whole thing happened, I remember it. I remember where I was, because I'm a parent. It was traumatizing. I thought about it for a week. It really bothered me, right? It bothered a lot of people. That's why so much money was raised. So the last thing I would ever want to do is hurt the families of victims. But when I heard that the school was closed, me being a researcher and a journalist, I'm like, wait a minute. I have to be ethical in what I do, look into this and go, okay, what is really the evidence behind this? And if that's true, then what the heck? And it's our duty as Americans to look into this, especially journalists, and say, what the heck? And that's why I invite the other side to tell me, well, what do you, I mean, how do you guys argue some of these things? Now, I got to tell you, Wolfgang won his case because Posner didn't show up.
That's right. That's right. Just as you're observing that I'm now being subjected to a lawsuit for defamation, Wolfgang was similarly subjected to a lawsuit for defamation. But Leonard Posner, that's what he calls himself, though that does not appear to be his name. In fact, Dr. Ewan, who maintains a Fellowship for the Mind's website, who had in fact published 80 articles about Sandy Hook before I edited the book, where I myself had published 30, did a national search during two respected search engines and could not find a person named Leonard Posner in all of the United States, Sarah. And the point you're making is impeccable. Lenny never appeared in court. Wolfgang went all to all the pretrial hearings. He had a highly incompetent attorney who seemed to have just graduated from law school, had no idea what he was doing. When the judge grew impatient and directed that Leonard Posner had to sit for a video deposition, rather than run the risk, he withdrew the lawsuit. And interestingly, Sarah, we have a parallel, because there's a program on Showtime called Dark Net, where they have a program that features briefly one clear-cut positive use of the internet, one clear-cut negative use of the internet, and in between a controversial case. And they chose to do Sandy Hook with me and Lenny Posner. And they came to my home, and just adjacent to where I'm sitting now, they filmed me for 4 hours. When I finally saw the broadcast, my face was better defined in that video than in any other I've ever seen, and I've been in hundreds. But Leonard Posner would not allow his face to be shown. He claimed it was because he didn't want his image on the internet subject to harassment, but the real reason appears to be the following. We have established, and I will show, that the images of Noah Posner were actually made up out of the images of the person supposed to be his older stepbrother, Michael Vabner, when he was a child. Research I have done, we have so many photographs of Lenny with Noah, when Noah turns out to be Michael Vabner. How appropriate that there are all these photographs, because Lenny is indeed the father of the person being called Noah. His real name appears to be Reuben Vabner. So he doesn't want someone to look at one of these videos and say, hey, I know that guy, that's Reuben Vabner, because that would blow his cover.
With the world being so crazy, I have two great gift ideas to help you and your family stay safe. First, the Shockwave Torch. This tiny tool drops a 260-pound thug in 2 seconds. It packs so much power in such a small package, it's scary. Thank God it's got a safety on it. If you want to stay safe in a dangerous world, I promise the Shockwave Torch will help. You can also get, as an additional item, this combo pack. It's an ultra-powerful police-grade 18% pepper spray with an ultra-discreet 3-million-volt stun gun. I am getting these for every one of the women in my family. I believe we should all be carrying this for self-defense. And with gun laws becoming stricter than ever, what a great option for women in your family, or even men in your family, to be safe. With purchase of any other item, you can get this for only $29. So click the links below to find out more information.
And they haven't disputed any of the facts that you have put forward. Is there any proof that they put forward that the school was actually open?
I think they're largely operating on the basis of presumptions that because the media has been so massive in its coverage and it's been so totally one-sided, the reason, of course, they won't cover me and my lawsuit is that it's one thing to attack Alex Jones, who actually has discredited himself by being on every side of the issue, or even to go after Wolfgang Halbig. But in my case, it's rather different. They want to impugn the credibility of the others. But with me, it's a far more difficult case. I graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University in 1962. I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. My undergraduate thesis received the Dickinson Prize. During the 4 years in the Marine Corps, I supervised recruit training. I had 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command, including marksmanship training. I was promoted to captain among the first in my group before I resigned my commission in 1966, entered graduate school and earned a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. I began a 35-year career in higher education in 1970, teaching at a wide variety of institutions of higher learning, including Kentucky, Virginia twice, North Carolina at Chapel Hill, New College at the University of South Florida, eventually being brought in as full professor with tenure on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. I published dozens, hundreds of articles. I was the editor of scholarly journals. I founded an international journal, which I solely edited for 10 years myself. I was among the first 10 to be elevated to the position of Distinguished McKnight University Professor by the University of Minnesota in 1996, which was a new form of recognition for full professors in their first years who have made particularly distinguished contributions to enhance the national and international reputation of the University of Minnesota. So I published 24 academic books on the nature of scientific knowledge, on the foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, evolution and mentality. I'm well known with many achievements to my record. I received the Medal of the University of Helsinki for my contributions to the philosophy of science, and NSF Research Fellowship on which I wrote my first book. I've held a MacArthur visiting professorship at New College, and then to become a McKnight professor. I've now been, since my retirement in 2006, and Sarah, this is after offering courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning for 35 years, I've become devoted to studying these cases which are politically significant, where the government might have a reason to deceive us. I began with JFK back in 1992. I have now published 4 books on JFK, and as I have implied, bringing together the best experts on different aspects of these cases. The first book of JFK, 1998, Assassination Science, established that the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a fist-sized blowout to the back of the head, that there were indications of a second shot to the head, that the brain shown in diagrams and photographs in the National Archives isn't even the brain of JFK, bringing together a world authority on the human brain who is also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics, who's also an MD and board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using x-ray therapy, so that he's an expert in the interpretation of x-rays. A physician was in trauma room 1 when JFK's moribund body was brought in, and then 2 days later responsible for the care and treatment of his alleged assassin. That was my first book on JFK. I've chaired or co-chaired 5 national conferences. My second book, Murder in Dealey Plaza, published in 2000, has been widely regarded as perhaps the best, single best book ever published on the assassination. My third, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, followed a conference on the campus of the University of Minnesota Duluth that was sponsored by the University of Minnesota, as was my first JFK conference in the Twin Cities. on the death of JFK in 1999. So you're now talking about someone who has academic and scholarly credentials, who's a former Marine Corps officer. This is not a guy you can demonize. This is not a guy you can trivialize. And therefore, I believe it's much more difficult, and they're counting on the mainstream press, as they have on the past, to simply not cover the case, because it's historic, as you're observing. It has a tremendous amount to do with the freedom of speech. It was very cleverly and narrowly contrived, and I'll explain how they went about it, Sarah. But I think it's because, you know, I'm just a very, very different guy and much more difficult to discredit.
Well, yeah, I think they're scared of you, so that's why they just take the videos offline. They can't do anything else other than just get rid of them. Now, Alex Jones is an easy target. And do you think that he is, I mean, he's obviously playing ball here and letting himself get taken down. And it's part of the whole game. But now, this Lenny Posner, you said, had a really terrible attorney. Why are they doing it? It's just for show again, I'm thinking. And the media won't cover. They'll cover the fact that the court case is going on, but they won't show that he has a crappy attorney, and they just fold it at the end.
Well, that was, of course, in this courtroom in Florida. Now, in my case, they've hired an attorney through a very prestigious law firm, well known in Minneapolis, Messbacher and Spence. They have two. They've now hired a third attorney. They're going all out here because I'm producing so much evidence, even in the course of discovery, because my answer to the complaint was so comprehensive. And those, by the way, are public documents. They're in the court record. I have a series of blogs where I've been informing the public about the progress of this case. And Sarah, if you have the opportunity, you may want to include them as links when you publish this interview. But I'm telling you, they're going all out here.
But how are they going to win? Are you scared at all? I mean, because if you're in the right with the truth, what are they going to do? Make stuff up? I mean, they already made, you know, what are they going
to
do?
Well, it's a very interesting case. They've tried to design it so narrowly that it focuses on one observation I have made about the whole case, namely that the death certificate, which Lenny Posner gave to a research colleague by the name of Kelly Watt, after 100 hours of conversation during which Kelly told him she didn't believe a word he said, didn't believe he had a son, didn't believe he died, he sent her a death certificate, which he shared with me. We co-authored an article about it in Chapter 11. You can read about it in the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, where, Sarah, let me share with your audience. When Amazon banned the book on the 19th of November, 2015, after it had been put on sale on the 22nd of October and sold nearly 500 copies in less than a month, it was obvious to me this was a political decision. So I immediately released the book for free as a PDF. Anyone can download it by simply entering the title, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, into their browser. One of the benefits they will have thereby is all the images are then in color. Now, if you want a hardcover, really it's a softback, you can go to moonrockbooks.com for the second edition, where we have five chapters that weren't in the original, and you'll have one you can carry around as you like. But meanwhile, you can actually download the book, and you can check out, for example, that Appendix A is the FEMA manual for the two-day exercise. And in Chapter 11 and other places in the book, you'll see the death certificate, which I will show during our conversation and we can discuss, which in my opinion is obviously a fabrication. It has no file number. It has a wrong estimated time of death at 11 a.m. when officially the shooting took place between 9:30 a.m. and 9:40. The bottom two thirds is dark texture, the top third light. It looks like they combined the bottom part of a real death certificate with the top half of a fake. It has lots of little typographical mistakes with different fonts. Some places the words are close to, the letters are close together, other places are separated. In other words, it was done in stages. It also has in the bottom right, where there's supposed to be a social security number for the decedent, it's blacked out. One would have presumed that that was because he was concealing the social security letter number for Noah. But when I was issued the subpoena for the case on the 29th of November last, after having been filed here in Dane County, where I reside in Oregon, a small town just 10 miles south of Madison, I discovered that in the state certified copy, there's a blank there where there ought to be a social security number, suggesting to me that in fact Noah Posner was never issued a social security number because he was a fiction. This is one of many aspects of the case. And we'll review it when we turn to the images, Sarah, because I'm sure your audience will be fascinated. Indeed, if you want to pull it up, we can look at the death certificate already.
We'll pull that up. Can I ask you one question before we get into this more? There are some people in the alternative media, Jake Morfonios being one, and I loved his work, and I loved him. And I'm so concerned that he's kind of done this flip. Do you know what happened there?
I have no idea. In all candor, I've never followed Jake, so I know almost nothing about him. I do realize there's something about him in a recent email I have that I have yet to study, but I can't take a position on this. I mean, listen, Sarah, for the sake of the audience, let's just begin at the beginning. You were saying once you realized that the school was closed, case closed. And I couldn't agree more.
Well, that's why I have such a hard time. And Jake has been so great. And so that's why I would invite him to come on, Lenny Posner, any of these people, and just tell me how could this happen if the school was closed? I mean, I just didn't get it. Now, let's go through those pictures that you wanted to go through so badly. And I think I want to see them too, yes.
I put up the cover for what we've been doing. Yes, that's perfect for the beginning up until now. But then look, here's a photograph where you can see one of the exits from Sandy Hook Elementary. It's a wooden stairwell that no wheelchair could navigate. And there's a steel rod extending that could pop the eyes out of a little kid. Remember, this was a kindergarten through fourth grade school. It was actually in deplorable condition. It was loaded with biohazards and asbestos. It had been damaged by a hurricane in 2007. It turns out there was a major flood in the area that appears to have affected what happened. Turn from that photograph that shows already that the school was not wheelchair accessible to a photograph of the parking lot. Now, sorry, you'd think that would be pretty innocuous, but you can actually prove that Sandy Hook was a scam just based upon the parking lot. Notice we have none of the familiar blue and white signage, none of the familiar blue and white parking lots, parking areas for handicapped parking. What that means is that even though the Americans for Disability Act was originally passed in 1990 and then updated in 2008, Sandy Hook Elementary was non-compliant. You have to have handicap parking. You have to have wheelchair accessibility. Inside the school was a disaster, too. Wolfgang and I actually put up videos from inside and outside the school. And you can see where in one of the bathrooms, they tried to yank out a commode to make it look as though it was wheelchair accessible. But a plumber who commented on the video said that was just a feeble effort that clearly this was a school that was being used for storage. But many said, who are former teachers, said, yes, that's what they do with an abandoned school. They use it for storage. So if you look at this photograph, you'll find there's none of the parking that would be necessary for handicapped if it were compliant. And since it was non-compliant, and I checked the laws for both the state and federal at the time, Sarah, this school could not have been legally operating under the law in 2012.
Wasn't there a document that said that it was closed? Or am I not? Am I remembering seeing something that I never really saw? I don't know.
Initially, there were even local residents who were saying they thought it was very odd there'd be any students there because the school had long since been abandoned. But the Lieutenant Paul Vance, who was in charge of the state police, threatened to prosecute anyone who offered a narrative at variance with the official account. In fact, it was his state police that asked representatives in Wolfgang Halbig's area to come to his front porch and threaten him with prosecution if he continued to pursue these issues. I believe they may have even used some form of national security letter to silence local residents because this was so blatant. But Alex Jones had a reporter up there who, in fact, had spoken with local residents who were confirming the school had been closed. What's also interesting about this photograph, Sarah, is that if you came in from Dickinson Drive at the lower right, which is the only access route, if you follow the driving instructions, you turn right and then curl around and come in and park facing away. But the fact is, in the center two rows, all the vehicles are parked facing the building. Evidently, it was much simpler just to bring them in a single line and put them in two by two by two, all facing the building, even though that was in violation of the driving instruction and the belief that no one's even going to notice. After all, these are just props. But it reveals that the whole thing was a scam just from something as innocuous as a photograph of the parking lot.
You have even more pictures of the problems with the students and other things. Can you move on to some of those pictures?
Absolutely.
I thought those were, go ahead.
Absolutely. The most stunning actually is Exhibit 24 in Chapter 8 in the book, and everyone who downloads it can verify this for themselves. In Chapter 7, we have 50 photographs of them furnishing an empty house to serve as the Adam Lanza residence. The most striking, and you can tell it's an empty house because there's nothing on the walls. There are no paintings, no photographs, no decorations, no plants in holders, nothing like that, which you'll find in every occupied residence. I believe that the real estate agent who made the home accessible for this purpose wanted to put it on the market, didn't want to have to deal with doing any minor repairs. We have the most striking photograph is from the Nancy Lanza bedroom where her son, Adam, whom I regard as fictional as Noah Posner and the other kids, is alleged to have shot his mother with a .22 caliber rifle. Now, there's doesn't appear to be blood on the bed. There's a little red stuff. I think it might be raspberry jam. If you go to the foot, there's a cedar chest with paper records there because they were tracking how they were arranging the rooms. But Kelly Watt, the very same to whom Lenny sent the fabricated death certificate, has her own home and commercial cleaning service, and with her keen eye spotted a blue moving pad beneath the leg of the bed that in their haste they'd forgotten to remove. Meanwhile, in the Chapter 8, we have 50 more photographs of them refurbishing the school to serve as the stage. The most significant is Exhibit 24, where you see a SWAT team vehicle. I've been told it's actually a crime scene vehicle, is present. It's quite substantial. And just above the roof of the vehicle, you can see a string of four windows in Classroom 10 that are undamaged. Now, you'd think in a kindergarten school, since this is the 14th of December, Christmas is approaching, it would be covered with Christmas and Hanukkah decorations, but there are virtually none to be seen. In these four windows, there are drawings of candles in those four windows, but that's virtually exhaustive of anything that might be construed. After the shootout, the second pane in particular would be massively damaged. So you can tell when you look at this photograph, it was taken before the event. The flagpole is at full mast. You come down the flagpole, and just to the right, there's an individual reclining against the wall with his arms folded, none other than Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. Look closer and you'll see there's crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. Now, in the first edition, we believe that this photograph had been taken the morning of the 14th, but subsequent shadow analysis has revealed it was actually taken the evening of the 13th, the day of the rehearsal. And by the way, you know, in the FEMA manual, it says that the event, the rehearsal on the 13th, will begin at 8 a.m. and end at 11:59 p.m. to be evaluated as a real event the following day, the 14th, when they claim the shooting took place.
How do they, how can they possibly dispute the FEMA manual?
I know.
The school's closed and the FEMA manual is even worse of a factual than the school being closed.
I think you're right. They want to claim that since the FEMA manual template is available online, that anyone could have made up something like this. But I defy anyone to look at that manual and imagine how anyone who weren't actually a FEMA professional could have made it up. It looks completely authentic to me. And more importantly, in confirming its authenticity, is the fact that the events on the ground confirm it. We had that sign, everyone must check in, where it says right in the manual, everyone must check in. It's the porta potties, the pizza and the water, bottled water at the firehouse. It's standard for FEMA events that you have refreshments and restrooms. The name tags on lanyards, standard for FEMA events. They identify the players with color-coded name tags on lanyards. And then, as I mentioned before, parents bringing children to the scene. No parent would bring their child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. So we not only have the manual, we have all of the imagery that supports that the events on the ground were in conformity. What they did at the day, Sarah, was to mix all this footage up so that you, if you were naive and assumed a whole bunch of jumbled things were being reported, it's only when you step back and apply an analytical framework to sort things out when you realize we're actually dealing with a two-day event where they had the rehearsal on the 13th. Would you believe, Sarah, some of the participants became confused about the date and actually put up donation web pages already on the 13th for an event that had yet to occur.
Do you have copies? Do you have pictures of that?
We have it. Yeah, it's all out there. We even Adam Lanza's death was initially reported in the Social Security Index as having happened on the 13th, making his feet and shooting 20 children and 6, including his mother, 7 adults the following day, all the more remarkable post-mortem.
You know, I've had people tell me that this is the worst false flag that they've ever done. I mean, it's the most incompetent. Would you say that? I mean, because this is incredible.
Well, I think they're putting their finger on something terribly important, namely that this was the first, and even though it turns out the Connecticut State Police were running the operation behind the scene in coordination with FEMA, it was the Connecticut State Police who took those photographs inside the purported Lanza residence. It was the Connecticut State Police who took the photographs at the school. Indeed, it's fascinating, Sarah, when Alex Jones, when InfoWars covered the banning of the book, they put up an even better version of the photograph of that SWAT team vehicle being present than I had. And an article about it. It was up for 38 minutes. They had over 138 comments before they took it down. And I captured a copy of it. And I have no doubt the reason they took it down was because it said Image Credit Connecticut State Police.
Jeez, it's just incredible that this stuff is here. And now there's a big story here as far as all these people flipping too and supporting it. Are they compromised? Are they being threatened? What is going on behind the scenes with some of these people? Are their children being threatened?
Well, as Sophia, small storm observed. This is what's known as a FEMA capstone event. It appeals to and draws in the whole community. I think there may have been residents of Newtown who thought they were doing good by showing something that could happen if we don't take weapons out of the hands of American citizens. It's a flawed premise, because it turns out that studies have shown that these weapons are used defensively, that between 2.2 and 2.5 million times Americans are using weapons to defend themselves from assaults, and that while there are over 5 million AR-15s out in the community, they've only been implicated in staged events where they actually were not used, which include Sandy Hook, Orlando, Parkland, and Las Vegas. I have such good people, Sarah, that we've done thorough research on all of these. I'm now doing a whole new series and going through these events with Dr. Catherine Horton, who's a particle physicist who's even lectured at Oxford. She's also a targeted individual. And my latest blog right now on my website at jamesfetzer.org embeds the first two of the videos we have done about these false flag attacks, where I go through a dozen or 15 and show you how it's done. What we have going on is the absurdity of a Michigan governor is moving to create a thought crime criminal index for people who don't agree with official narratives about these events. This is totally Orwellian. So that if you go to my blog, jamesfetzer.org, you'll see an article about this Orwellian event that's trying to control even how we think. But it embeds the first two of my interviews with Dr. Horton, where we talk about the Boston bombing, Sandy Hook, Parkland, JFK, 9/11, Las Vegas. By the time you get through all four, you'll understand how these things are being done. Now, a key to all of this, Sarah, is that the Barack Obama administration was behind it. They nullified the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 by what they call the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012, but it essentially eviscerated the Smith-Mundt Act, which had precluded the use of the same techniques of disinformation and propaganda within the United States that were being used without. In other words, they unleashed a barrage, a flood of propaganda on the American people by taking that measure. It's completely outrageous.
It's treason. These people need to go down for treason. I just so hope that this, and I want you to continue about your research, but I just really hope they start taking these people down with these indictments. I mean, this is over the top, and the American people, if we want to save our country, these kinds of things need to come clean, and these people need to be brought to justice. I understand how people would create a false flag with the ends, you know, that means justify the ends of trying to get guns out of hands. And they have this delusion thinking that if they fake this event, it will get guns out of people's hands. But that is treasonous.
Well, it's also a calamity, because gun ownership and the homicide rates are inversely related.
Exactly.
In other words, they'd have us believe the more guns, the more gun deaths. But the truth is the opposite. Anyone ought to look at Chicago and see that experiment with strict gun control laws as a failure.
I did a documentary showing all the stats on that. So if anybody wants to see it, I went through all of that showing the opposite. I drilled down to the different neighborhoods, everything that you're talking about. But go ahead.
Brilliant. Sarah, I congratulate you for that, because what we're in the midst of is a two-pronged effort. The assault on the First Amendment is because through the internet, citizen investigators such as myself and my colleagues are exposing these shams across the board, so that they've had to use the social media giants and Leonard Posner's misnamed Honor Network, which, as I have said, has succeeded in taking down over 10,000 items. I wonder how many of mine he's taken down. Mike Adams was the most responsive to the banning of my book. He did three different pieces about it, including an interview with me back in 2015. He was dumbfounded, which in already in 2018, as I recall, his whole website was taken down because of the interview he did with me in 2015.
Well, didn't Richie Allen get shut down because of the interview with you?
Yes, yes, yes. So that it's happened again and again and again. So when he came back to me, and actually it was right at the start of 2018, and did another interview with me, I thought he was showing great integrity. At the time he was taken down, he had over 1,700 videos. He had over 200,000 subscribers. And while he regained his website, all the links that went around the world were broken forever. So when he did the interview with me, I thought he was showing great integrity. And after 6 or 7 weeks passed and he hadn't published it, I thought perhaps he'd change his mind. But then he put it up using a phrase he'd introduced at the end of our conversation, most dangerous mind in America on false flags and extreme censorship. And it was a wonderful article. Now, this is a guy who's ranked as the second most influential on the internet. And they're continuing to go after him too, Sarah. So the fact of the matter is that we're in a struggle to preserve the First Amendment because they don't want to have the sham of their efforts to take away our weapons exposed. So the attack on the Second Amendment can't succeed unless they compromise our First Amendment right. And it turns out that Google, YouTube, Facebook are all participants in this mass scam to deprive the American people of their right to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And it's a profound threat to the integrity of our government. Thomas Jefferson was once asked if he'd prefer a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government. He said then he'd prefer the latter to the former, but he had no idea of the degree of corruption of the major media in the United States today, Sarah. It turns out the CIA began infiltrating the media back in the 1950s in Operation Mockingbird. So that already by 1975, William Colby, then its director, testified to Congress that the agency owned everyone of any significance in the media. And to date, it's much, much worse. There's also been collusion between the Mossad and the CIA in these events, where I hope I'm not going to cause consternation when I explain that I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, that we had a fantastic year in 2006, where we wound up having as many as 800 members in four different categories, and I brought together pilots, physicists, engineers, mechanical, structural, civil, aeronautic, in the search for truth. We maintain a website, which is, you can still find at 911scholars.org, where I was personally responsible for every single item that appeared on that website. We promoted conferences, of which I organized several. We featured articles and blogs. We announced lectures. We put up videos. It was a great success. The culmination of my research has now been published in a book also at Moonrock Books, where it turns out, really fairly astonishing, given all the propaganda we've heard about it, but that the Twin Towers were so massive that they had to use small nuclear devices in order to take them down. It was a tube within a tube design. So they had a nuke at the basement of each of the Twin Towers that went upward, destroying the building from the inside. And then we saw it blow apart in every direction from the outside, be converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, which, by the way, is one of the signatures of the use of nuclear explosives. And when it was done, Sarah, unlike Building 7, which came down 7 hours later at 5:20 in a classic controlled demolition, where all the floors are coming down at the same time because all the support columns have been blown simultaneously, where even Dan Rather live was observing. That's just like the destruction of the resorts and casinos we see in Las Vegas. It was a classic controlled demolition that left a pile of debris equal to 12% of the height of the original 47 floors or 5.5 floors. Had it been a collapse of the Twin Towers, you would have had 12% of 110 or 13 and a half floors in each of their footprints. But as Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church reported on my radio shows where I featured him twice, those buildings were destroyed to or even below ground level. And you have videos and photographs that confirm it. The reason they had to use an ingenious mode of demolition is because the Twin Towers were erected in what was known colloquially as the bathtub. It was a dike to keep Hudson River water out. If, in fact, any portion of those massive 500,000-ton buildings had shattered the bathtub, Hudson River water would have flooded beneath lower Manhattan, and it would have been a catastrophe. This is the most valuable real estate in the world. So they had to take very special pains to design an ingenious version of it. Joe Olson, who is himself a civil and structural engineer, and I just engaged in a debate called Rumble Over the Rubble with Steve Dack, who wants to argue that it was done with conventional explosives and because the buildings were of shoddy construction, when the opposite is the case. You can find that by doing a search on Rumble Over the Rubble. Fascinating review, because our debate became rather strenuous. But the fact of the matter is, as the book's title reflects, and again, I brought together 15 experts on different aspects of the case, America Nuked on 9/11, compliments of the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, and the Mossad, where the neocons had come from the Project for a New American Century that emerged in the wake of the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1990-91, promoting the illusion that it would be possible to create a new American empire that would endure for the next 100 years, hence the title Project for a New American Century. If only the U.S. would move aggressively into the Middle East and exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from that geopolitically sensitive area. But as Wesley Clark would reveal in 2007 in a speech he gave at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, the actual agenda was to take out the governments of five countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran, in order to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region. And I'm very, very troubled that the man who is now occupying the office, for whom I voted because I believed him when he said he was going to put America first, get the United States out of the Middle East, where he overlapped with Bernie Sanders in that regard, and where I believe that if Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC had only allowed Bernie to be the nominee, his campaign was actually sabotaged, where 13 primaries that Bernie had won were given to Hillary in order to guarantee she'd be the candidate, because Bernie and the Donald foreign policy overlap, but Bernie's domestic policies are so much more beneficial to the American people than the Donald's. I believe Bernie would have beat Donald Trump.